accession number 2030, correction 20300, reel 2.
Mr. Cobra, reel 2.
Well, I followed the CO, and there were a number of soldiers moving along in no sort of order, in the same direction as he was going. And we came off the hill into the comparatively safety of a what we call a nullah, a dry riverbed. And then he clambered over that, then we went through some more scrub and things. And he didn't say where he was going. Then we came to another nullah, and he moved right along it up to the road, climbed out onto the road, and I followed him, and something made me stop, because I'd sensed some movement, and I saw some bushes move about 50 yards away on the side of the road, and so I shouted out to him, look out, sir, the Japs ahead. He didn't take any notice, and three shots rang out, and he was hit in the wrist, first of all. He had a walking stick only, and then he fell onto the road, I realized that I hadn't got the upper body strength to lift him or anything. There was no one else with me at that moment. But I had identified the place from where the shots came. It was on the corner of the road, because I'd seen the bush move. And there was only room for about two Japanese, I think, there, if any. And on the left-hand side of the road, it was jungle and impassable, and on the right there was a pretty impassable hill of jungle, and above it. And anyhow, I turned round to try and get some chaps to help me recover him. But I hadn't seen those people, or those troops walking, hadn't seen any with machine guns. Can I stop this for a moment? But anyway, as I was saying, I hadn't noticed any automatic weapons, but I had noticed a chap who'd been walking along over the hill not far from me with one of these grenade caps at the top of his rifle. You put a grenade into it to fire. And I thought that would be very useful, because he could lob it on to the spot where I'd seen the Jap shoot from. And I had in mind getting him, if I could, and one or two others. So I turned down, I was halfway up the climbing from the nullah onto the road when the CO was hit. It was even I called out, and I'd stopped and called out to him. And then I turned round and called out for help, to get people. But no one answered. They'd all gone to ground. So then I clambered up the road, up onto the road. I mean, up so I could see down the road. And to my astonishment, I saw that Colonel Dower had picked himself up and was sort of staggering back. So I rushed out onto the road and helped him along to the top of the nullah where we had climbed out. And fortunately, then a couple of Jawans, young Indian soldiers, appeared to help. They didn't put their head over the top, but one of them climbed halfway up, and between us we lured the Colonel Dow down. It's quite a way down the thing into the dry riverbed, and the Japanese didn't shoot at us, although we must have been sitting targets. And as I have explained in my book, I think chivalry was never one of their characteristics. I think the reason was there was only one man there. He had a limited amount of ammunition, and he wasn't prepared to waste it on Colonel Dow and myself while we were getting out of sight. So we went down there. Then I dressed his wounds. The two men disappeared. I dressed his wounds as best I could, using both our field dressings. But he was in a bad state. His jaw was shot away. He'd been wounded in the jaw in the frontier in India earlier, and that all came out. He sort of had everything rebuilt. That all came out, and he couldn't speak. He waved me away. He couldn't I know what he was getting at, that I should go. And I had actually, before the Jawans had disappeared, they did carry him down the riverbed, the dry riverbed, towards the river, and I selected a spot which is quite comfortable in grass and things for him there. And they were there then. And it was also had a certain amount of cover from the air and view. So I thought at that time I still had hopes that the Dogras were going to come to our rescue, you see. And I thought that we'd have quite a good chance, because if they did, of hiding there in that position. It's quite not a bad one. That's when I dressed his wounds, and that's when the two Jawans disappeared. And then I was there for some time. He couldn't speak. I walked up and down the nullah, trying to see if I could find anyone to organize. But I didn't find anybody. There wasn't anyone there. But I also selected a hiding place for myself, because although I still had hopes that the Dogras were coming, it was getting less and less as time went by. And it was obvious the Japanese completely defeated us, you see. And when they started beating the bushes and shooting the odd people, odd shots rang out and beating the bushes, I said goodbye to Colonel Dow and went up into my hiding place. And they came down, they found him naturally enough, and there was a lot of hooing and hawing I heard down. It's about 20 yards from where I found my hiding place, up in a thicket, a very good hiding place, up in, on the side of the nullah. And I didn't know at the time, because so many odd shots were falling out, high up what was happening. But I heard afterwards that they had moved him to along the riverbed, because it was very... it had been the end of it was in the dry season, and you could walk along the side of the river quite comfortably, so baked mud or whatever. And I think he went by the ferry, I heard. Anyhow, they shot him, which is frankly is what he'd wanted, and in doubt whatever about that, because I mean he never survived in a Japanese prison camp. And he had shown no. He knew the battle was over, and and he didn't speak to me about what he intended to do. We didn't have much chance. But one thing I'm quite certain he wouldn't do, as I say in my book, he had no intention of surrendering to the Japanese. Anyhow, he was shot. I did what I know he'd have wanted, which is my duty, obviously, to try and get back. And I then stayed there, and several times Japs went past and sort of looked up, and I remained absolutely still and moved on. And then I think I must have got careless, actually, but two of them came along. One did the same, looked up, and the second one looked up. And as he went past, I think I must have relaxed or something, or something else caught his corner of his eye, because he came back. And he stared up at me. And, well, the Jap stood there looking up at me. And I remained absolutely still with my pistol trained on his face. And I realized that I got only one chance. I had to, if he indicated that he'd seen me, I'd have to shoot him dead, hurtle down, try to keep well balanced, and shoot the first Jap before he could do anything with his rifle on me. And then my intention was to run down the nala, past the dying CO, which you wouldn't need me moved by then, I suppose, down to the river, and then go along the bank and try and get in somewhere else. That was my plan. But after staring at me, so it seemed, he moved on. There was no third Jap. And that was the last of the searching. So I stayed there. The battle had taken place in the early hours of the morning, and it was still morning, late morning, I suppose, by then. But I couldn't leave there because the road I described was between me and Duin Zik, where I wanted to go to, because the road went parallel with Salwin, then turned right, sharp right angles, almost where the Jap position was. It was on the corner there where that Jap had shot Colonel Dyer. But the road was in full use all the time, and I thought I was pretty clever. So, I mean, I worked out well what the Japanese commander would do. I thought they'd be certain to go on up the road, follow up their victory over us, because the road led to Tatoan, to across Duin Zik to Tatoan, which was the main major city in southern Burma then, having lost Mul Main. Of course, they didn't. Japanese never did that at all. And I think everyone in 17th Indian Division would have thought the same. That's what they'd have done. But I decided, well, if they're going to do that, I haven't got much of a chance. My best bet is to go up river at night. I decided to go up river at night, because I knew that I could walk along the banks and things, so I stayed there until nightfall, then I moved out past where Jerry Dyer had been, and turned up the river. I had to pass the ferry. It was still night, and suddenly, I'd waited till dusk, really. So when I got to the ferry, suddenly, the whole area was flooded in light, and the Japanese had erected arc lights, and there was a boat coming across from Pahang, I was lucky enough to find a boat sort of pulled up on the bank there, and threw myself down. Just as someone dashed down to meet the boat coming across within a few feet of me. But no one saw me. And I stayed there for a bit, but I thought perhaps when they'd unloaded that boat, they'd stop. They didn't. They were going on. Obviously, it seemed they were going to go on all night, and I couldn't get past because it was in night, so therefore I decided to give my plan B and ran out of this area of light backwards along the river, and I wasn't spotted. Fortunately, I hadn't gone all that far towards the ferry, and anyhow, no one noticed me, and I nipped back. Then I went down the river past the nullah that I was talking about, turned right into the would be the village of Cousay, I'd intended to pass the village and go to the south of it, but it's a straggling place, and I found I was in the middle of it. I was getting worried about time I'd wasted. I thought it was time I should move on. My plan B was to go south of the road to Inzig to the River Don Tami, swim across that, and then go to Tatone or up to Inzig to have joined our forces there. In fact, actually, that, as events turned out, was a better bet, because what the Japanese did was go up through the jungle north parallel with Salween. They didn't go across to Tatone at all. The idea was that they were taking, they're absolutely first class troops in those days, and they could go through the jungle. Anyway, I had I went through that village of Cousay. They were all asleep. I guess sounds asleep. No one spotted me. No one's in shops or anything there. All they do is just eat and sleep, what I can see, or work in daytime. Then I had quite a job. I have described in my book how shortly afterwards I'd seen this man with a lamp. I'd seen a lamp coming towards me. I was on a sort of path above a rice field, a bund, if you like, going through a rice field and everything. I fortunately threw myself down, flat down, file after file of Japanese troops marched over just above my head. Being led by this Burman, I didn't see his face, but obviously it was a Burman with a lamp showing the way, I had great difficulty in moving that. I had to wait till they'd gone, then I carried on, and I saw several other parties doing exactly the same. A whole division was going up, and I that was the only time it was very, very near. They were right on top of me. Otherwise, I'd spotted them well ahead and took appropriate cover. But I won't go into details. But the next 2 days, I had quite a one or two experiences of that kind, which again I have written about. I wasn't able to that night. I was doing all this at night, and then after the moon came up, it was easier to find the way. Anyway, to cut a long story short, the next day I was in a... I had to spend the whole day. I'd climbed up upon some sort of hill, and as it was going to get daylight, I'd climbed up a bit, and thought I'd have a rest because I hadn't had any sleep or anything, but I hadn't intended to fall fast asleep. But I was young in those days, and I fell fast asleep and woke up to find that not only dawn come, but I was woken up by giggles and shouts and things, and it was a Japanese petting party. It wasn't rape. There were some Japanese, obviously Japanese and Burmese girls down below the anyway. And I was in some rocky things above, and I had to spend the whole day there. Nothing I could do about it. They wouldn't go, so I couldn't move. Then the next day, they went. I was able to get out, and sort of about 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock, they'd gone. I was getting rather desperate. I had no food, and I went into a village for food and water because I was getting fairly desperate. And I prodded my pistol at a Burmese because I went, clambered up one of these houses and he started to jab at me, and I wanted to be quiet. He had a bowl of rice there. I stuck my pistol in him and still didn't stop him jabbering to everybody. And grabbed some rice, put it in my pocket, and then dashed off. But I realized that they told that my presence would have been reported, and the next day at about 4 o'clock, I suppose, some Japanese. I was hiding again. I knew it was being searched. Again, I got a very good hiding place. But I was sort of dozing off and preparatory for my one last go. I'd hoped to reach the River Domtami. I didn't know how near I was. As I say in my book, I think I was probably fairly near, actually. I had very good reasons for that. By looking at the map and the length of time it took once I was taken prisoner. But anyhow, I don't know how much you want about this, but or whether you want to read about my captivity. I mean, should I tell?
Yes.
What do you want me to say?
Well, if you can just give as much as you can, please.
Right. Well, I in the early morning, I climbed a tree. To see if I could spot the River Domtami, because it was much open space. I knew from my map it would be, so I was in the right sort of area, and I'd come out of the jungle, and I wasn't able to spot it, but unfortunately I saw a young Burmese boy, staring up at me. I grinned at him and put my finger up like this to say, I said, don't give me away. But he moved away, and I climbed down and carried on with my to try and find the Domtami. But I could hear sounds of searching, and after a bit, I decided to go into. I found a good hiding place in a thicket again, which. The entrance into the thicket, which I had to crawl under, it's a very dark thicket, was away from the footpath, and I couldn't be seen from the footpath. And then I went in there, I suppose at about 3 o'clock or something like that, I thought, and I realised that I was getting desperate, but I thought I'd have to wait till nightfall to make one last chance. Meanwhile, I thought I would have a rest and doze off. And I must have left my legs sticking slightly out of where I was in hiding for someone going round the bush. And because next thing I had a great roar, and I saw this man naked to the waist. I didn't know whether it was Burmese or Japanese, but he had a long jungle knife, you see, which he raised, quivering, to plunge into my heart. He then, that woke me up, but he then shifted. He decided, I think, frankly, to castrate me, sort of move it so that he could come hit me. In my book, I describe it as a softer a part of my anatomy. But anyway, that gave me a chance to act, and I was lying on my revolver, but I shot my hand out to the left. Followed it with my eyes like that and said, look over there, you fucking cunt, is what actually the words I used. And I don't put them in my book, I just said blank. And pulled the my revolver, which I lent him, and as I pulled it up towards his head, he dropped the knife, grabbed the my pistol. I pulled the trigger, and just as it was going past my, he was going like that, and I pulled the trigger just for a bit, but it didn't go off. And he's much stronger than I was, anyway, pulled down like that. Meanwhile, he was nattering to the Japs outside. They were, he was a Jap, but I didn't know at the time. I was worried about me, saw what he was, but and they obviously told him to bring me out, because he'd taken my gun from me, and then he pointed me to, he stopped trying to carve me up and told me to go out. He indicated I should go out, so I went out into the late afternoon sun, and there were about five or six sections of these Asiatic, or in fact Japanese. They're just dressed in shorts, then there are no top vest on at all, and they all carried these knives. But surprisingly, they weren't unfriendly, the other lot. I said, "Are you Japanese?" I did have sense not to say, "Are you Japs?" But I said, "Are you Japanese?" And one of them nodded, you see, and they indicated I should walk along with them. We all went along a mass, about five of others surrounding me. And then one of them tapped my watch, you see, and pointed to himself. And I had the sense to, not to argue, but to give it to him. And that was a sign for them all to start to search me, you see. But I hadn't got anything. All I got, when I'd been hiding myself, and in that when I'd been hiding after the battle, I'd thrown away everything except for my map, pistol, and all I had were these few grains of rice. And they were quite. There were some grunts of sympathy, and I sort of responded when they saw the rice. I responded in a what I call a smiling, friendly way, and they indicated that they would give me water, because I hadn't got any, and food. And they gave me water, and indicated they'd give me food later. So we marched along quite friendlily till we came to a clearing where there's a horrible man who was obviously in charge. He had a shirt and a bigger, much bigger sword. He was obviously a Japanese NCO. And he shouted to them to stand round me, and they all stood round me with their, and he ordered them to put the points of their the blades, the points of the knives against me like that. But which they did. They weren't over enthusiastic. I'd been walking along quite friendlily with them, but these were the orders. And I started, well, I suddenly realized, I don't know, instinctively, that my best chance of survival was to behave in the way that a British officer is expected to behave anyway, and to show no trace of fear, because I just had a feeling if I'd, that any